from the perspective that quantum theory is a sort of theory about your knowledge and this sort of thing, which means, I mean, for someone who thinks that quantum states and PAVMs and that sort of thing are objective, concrete things out there in the world, then an unknown problem is just a problem that we don't know what it is yet. But if you think that quantum states are states of knowledge and that PAVMs are just states of knowledge, then you need to make sense of what you're doing when you do tomography to determine an unknown PAVM. So the story for this goes back to this guy who's called Definetti. And he was interested in the correct understanding of classical probability theory. And his understanding he summarized as probability does not exist. And by this he meant that probability doesn't exist out there in the world. There isn't some property of the world that means something happens with some probability. For him, a probability is just a number that says how likely you think something is to happen. So there's a few questions you might ask about this point of view. One might be, well, if it's just my knowledge, why should I represent it by a real number between 0 and 1? Why should I use all these rules for doing calculations with them? And you can answer that by sort of, for example, supposing that you're going to use your knowledge about something to bet on it. And you could ask, what sort of stakes are you willing to bet on an event happening with? And then if you don't want your bet to lose for sure, then there's certain rules that you should follow when you're making these bets. Another question you might ask is, what are people talking about? This is something scientists do a lot when they try and estimate a probability. Okay, so they do some experiment, they do something 1,000 times, it happens 600 times, you know, an event they're looking for happens 600 times, and they say, oh, I'd say the probability for this is about 0.6. So it seems like they're measuring a probability, which, if probabilities don't exist, sounds like complete nonsense. But Definetti managed to sort of square this circle. And the way he does that is by saying, well, if you do one of these measurements where experiments where you do something 1,000 times, you're not just talking about one event. You're talking about 1,000 times when something could or could not happen. And so really, the way you should express your beliefs about what's going to happen is as a probability distribution for those 1,000 events. But you know, maybe you might actually decide you're going to run the experiment 2,000 times or 3,000 times, and you'll have expectations about what's going to happen there too. So in fact, your knowledge takes the form of a sequence of probability distributions over more and more copies of the same variable. And furthermore, those probability distributions can, completely optionally, satisfy certain conditions, which are natural in the sort of setting where you're repeatedly doing this, what you consider to be the same experiment. And these conditions are called exchangeability. So we say that a sequence of probability distributions is exchangeable if each individual probability distribution is symmetric. So for example, there's no difference between P2XY and P2YX. So that means we don't think there's anything special about any particular run of the experiment. We could have done the runs in a different order and it wouldn't have made any difference. And there's also this condition that if we take our probability distribution for 1,001 experiments and just forget what happened in the last experiment, that should be like exactly the same as doing the experiment 1,000 times. And that's what the second condition expresses. So under certain circumstances, you might have beliefs about what's going to happen if you repeat some activity an arbitrary number of times. They might satisfy these conditions. And if they do, then you can apply what's called the Definetti theorem. And that says that if a sequence of probability distributions satisfies those conditions, it has a unique representation as a mixture of probability distributions for each shot of the experiment. So this is exactly what you would write down if there was some unknown parameter P out there in the world, and you thought, which you have some prior probability distribution for, given by this guy, and you thought that each run of the experiment was just independently sampling from this probability distribution. But this probability distribution doesn't actually have to exist out there in the world. It's just a mathematical artifact of these probability distributions on the left satisfying those exchangeability conditions. So you express your beliefs about the experiment using this infinite sequence of probability distributions. But if your beliefs take a certain form, then it's as if you believe that there is some objective probability out there that you're measuring.
Determine this theorem of order 1 over n?
Yeah, there are finite versions of the theorem. I'm not massively familiar with that. But yeah, I think it would be something like that. So the thing on the left is the sort of fundamental representation of your knowledge, and then the thing on the right is just a convenient way of expressing that knowledge under certain circumstances. And then, actually, first of all, I'll just give you a quick example. Let's say that you've got a coin and you're planning to toss that coin lots of times. Then Definetti says that the way you should represent your beliefs about what's going to happen is just as a series of probability distributions. So if you're going to toss the coin once, then you think there's some probability of heads and some probability of tails. If you're going to toss it twice, you think there's some probability of heads, heads, tails, etc. And if you think that you really are just tossing the same coin in the same way lots of times, then your beliefs will probably satisfy those exchangeability conditions. An example of some beliefs that satisfy it are these. So you think that if you toss it once, half the time it'll come up heads, half the time tails. You think if you toss it twice, half the time you'll get heads, heads, half the time you'll get tails, tails, so on. So all of these probability distributions are symmetric. And if, for example, I add up these two matrices, which corresponds to ignoring the last thing, I get that. So this is an exchangeable sequence of probability distributions. So by the Definetti theorem, I can represent this as a mixture of single-shot probability distributions. And in this case, the representation is just with 50% probability, this is a coin that gives heads all the time, and with 50% probability, this is a coin that gives tails every time. So all of this so far is just expressing our beliefs. We haven't actually measured anything. But then let's say you actually start tossing the coin. And let's say you toss it once and you observe the value x1. Well, now you've got some data, and so you should update your probabilities. And the way you do that is you just, your probabilities for the future coin tosses are just given by the conditional probability for those future tosses, given that you got the thing you got for the first toss. Okay? And you just calculate that conditional probability in the normal way. Okay, this is just probability of A given B is probability of A and B divided by the probability of B. But now, since this is an exchangeable probability distribution, if I calculate the probability just of x1, then that's just given by p1 of x1. And now, if you actually plug in the forms that the Diffinetti theorem gives you for pn and for p1, you'll find that your new conditional probability distribution again has this Diffinetti form of an integral over probability distributions. But the measure over probability distributions has just been updated like this. And this is exactly how you would update this probability distribution if p was an unknown variable and you were updating your beliefs about it in the normal way. Okay, this is just, again, the probability of A and B divided by the probability of B. So your beliefs take the same form as if there was this unknown probability P out there. And then when you start doing measurements, you update your probabilities as if there was this unknown P out there that you were estimating. So this means that we can make sense of the notion of an unknown probability without actually admitting that there's any objective probabilities out there at all. And here's how you might, that updating process might look. There are a lot of people who take a very similar view of the quantum state and say there's nothing out there in the world that is the objective quantum state. It's again just a way of representing our knowledge. And so that sort of Diffinetti way of saying that might be quantum states do not exist. But again, something that we do a lot, or I don't do it, but some people do, is measure an unknown quantum state. This is called state tomography. And so we need a way of understanding what's going on there if you want to take this view that doesn't actually admit that there's some unknown quantum state really out there that we're measuring.
I think that the theorem is an interesting theorem. Somehow I missed what it accomplished. I mean, what if I just said that I think the probability is the product of the individual probabilities? I could have just started there, is that right? This theorem just gives me another starting point.
You could have just The theorem is a sort of motivation for why you'd have probabilities of that form. The idea is that the exchangeability conditions are some sort of natural conditions that could be justified in a conceptual way, and then this is the sort of mathematical manifestation of those conditions.
But for many people, this would be a natural.
This is a very natural way of writing it down if you think there really is some p and that you're just sampling from that p n times. But if you don't think that...
Well, but you thought that there was some p for the sequences. I don't really see the conceptual difference.
I think that the conceptual difference is that the reason why you just, from the beginning, write this down would be is if you thought that there's some p and you don't know what it is. Right, that's what would, I think, lead you to write this down straight away. If you don't think there's a P out there, why are you even mentioning this P? What is it?
Well, I'm not an advocate of that whole approach, but...
for someone who thinks probabilities are objective, they would just write this down straight away and not be worried about it, for sure. This is trying to give an account of how somebody who doesn't think probabilities.
But they wrote something else down. But you wrote something else. Well, okay. But we can. The other thing is supposed to be more compatible with objective, subjective probability. That's what your claim is.
I mean, the first thing you wrote down has p's in it all over the place. Probabilities of sequences.
But those are known probabilities. So those are just numbers that you already have.
The numbers. I thought they were your degrees of belief about the sequences.
Yeah, they are, but they're your degrees of belief. So they. Well,
how do you know what your degrees of belief? That's what I don't understand. Where did those come from?
They're just your prior beliefs. They came from whatever you know before you start running the experiment. So if you know that you got the coin from someone you trust, then probably your prior beliefs are that it's almost certainly a fair coin. If you bought the coin from a joke shop, your prior probabilities are probably that it's quite a biased coin, for example.
Yes.
So these things here are all known numbers.
But then they might or might not satisfy this exchangeability.
Yeah.
What if they don't satisfy this?
Then you can't write it in this form, and you shouldn't act as though you're estimating some unknown probability. Right.
But there's no way I would have such a set of numbers as my beliefs. I mean, I can't really. The only way I can imagine getting such a set of numbers was be by this formula that you wrote down.
Yeah. So the theorem says that. As long as your beliefs, if you did write them out, would satisfy the exchangeability criteria, then it's fine just to talk about it in the form on the right-hand side. So yeah, you do never have to write down this unwieldy set of probability distributions.
Awesome.
But it's just about a motivation for writing down that form in the first place.
But somehow this is magically giving us objective. Turning what you might have called objective probabilities into subjective probabilities.
No, the reverse.
Well, either way you want to say. I mean, it's allowing us to replace the notion of objective probability with a purely subjective notion. That's the claim, anyway.
I think the claim is that it allows someone who thinks all probabilities are subjective to, under certain circumstances, act as if there was some objective probability that they were. After. Purely based on the nature of their subjective beliefs that they have before they start.
Maybe one way to think of it would be as kind of a response to somebody who's arguing in favor of objective probabilities. They might say, well, the way we normally update our probabilities suggests that there's some parameter of the coin that we're estimating, and therefore, you know, that's how we should think about the weighting of the coin as some physical property as a challenge to the subjectivist. And then given Diffinetti's theorem, the subjectivist can respond, no, I'll do the calculation exactly the same way as you do, even though I can still deny that there's an objective property to the coin.
Yeah, I want to come back to the issue I raised because to me it's germane here. I understand the force of that argument, Bob, that you just gave, in the case that there would be an infinite number of cases in the sequence. But if there's a finite number of cases in the sequence, and I only get, and the theorem only holds up to an error term, I seem to be in a regress. That it's, I seem to have to ask, what's my degree of belief about my degree of belief? This must be something that's been thought through. Is there a...
I think there's no... There's no problem about just using the infinite version of the theorem, because if you have an experiment that can be in principle repeated an arbitrary number of times, then you'll have beliefs about what will happen when it's done an arbitrary number of times.
Well,
in fact, you're only ever going to do it a finite number of times.
I might not. I mean, I might have a view that the world is finite, and I might definitely not have a view about what would happen if I didn't. I might think that that's nonsense to talk
okay.
about doing an experiment.
In yeah, sure. So in that case, you can't fully capture your beliefs in this form. So, I mean, this isn't trying to say that all beliefs have to be put in this form. All this is saying is that there are circumstances in which somebody who does believe that probability is subjective, nevertheless, might act as if they were trying to guess some objective probability. It's not saying that that's all they ever do, right? You can have absolutely any subjective beliefs you want. You know, you might think that you're only going to be able to do the experiment once and then it's going to blow up. In that case, there's no point in talking about subjective beliefs.
But supposing that I do believe that probabilities don't exist in any objective sense, then the comfort that I get from this De Finetti theorem is lessened by the need to believe in an absurdity of an infinite number of cases to gain comfort from.
Perhaps. I think the important lesson is, you know, that it's a concept that under some circumstances you can make sense of. Whether or not that then actually turns out to be applicable in any particular situation is, I think, less important.
So what are people talking about when they do quantum tomography on an unknown quantum state? Well, it's going to be a very similar story. They're going to imagine that they might choose to prepare one system, or they might choose to prepare two systems, or they might choose to prepare three systems. And their beliefs about those systems are going to be expressed as quantum states. But if they think that those repeated preparations are in some sense the same preparation, then it might be natural for them to assume that these quantum states are going to be an exchangeable sequence of quantum states, which, just like in the probability case, means that each of them is symmetric under permutations of the systems. And if you trace out one of the systems in the state of n plus one systems, you just get your state for n systems. And then you get a De Finetti theorem for quantum states, which just says, in this case, your beliefs are the same as if there was some unknown quantum state rho, which you have some prior beliefs about, and you're just repeatedly preparing that quantum state rho.
Yes, I was just wondering about this result. Given that there's a one-to-one corresponding between quantum states and
probabilities they induce on some informationally complete measurement, and because of that correspondence and because of the existing De Finetti theorem for the probabilities, which are the experimental outcomes, doesn't it kind of follow for free automatically without any work?
Yeah, essentially. So this first paper here from the 1970s, they proved this from first principles using a load of maths. And then the second paper here, they just used exactly that observation. So a quantum state just is a probability distribution over some information complete measurement. The only slight twist is that, You imagine doing an informationally complete measurement on every copy of the system, and then it's pretty easy to see that gives you an exchangeable classical probability distribution, which you can apply the theorem to. But then there isn't actually a guarantee that all of the probability distributions that you get in the De Finetti form, classical De Finetti form, will actually be distributions that correspond to valid quantum states. Okay. Not any old classical probability distribution over the outcomes of an informationally complete measurement actually corresponds to a quantum state. Whereas the idea is that all of these guys actually are valid positive quantum states. So when you do it this way, the only technicality is proving that all of the things are actually quantum states and not negative. So this very much builds on the classical one. And then people talk about doing tomography on a quantum channel. So again, you want to make sense of that. You define a notion of an exchangeable sequence of channels, and you get a theorem for this. And again, this piggybacks on the previous one. A channel is isomorphic to a bipartite state by the Choi-Jan-Wachowski isomorphism. So you just turn your sequence of channels into a sequence of states. You apply the De Finetti theorem for quantum states to that.
And then all you need to do is check that the states that you end up with a distribution over are all states that could have come from a channel. In other words, they're all ones where one of the subsystems is maximally mixed. Okay, so what we wanted to do was just sort of fill in the last bit of this puzzle, basically. So you can make sense of the notion of an unknown quantum state. You can make sense of the notion of an unknown quantum channel. Can you make sense of the notion of an unknown quantum measurement? And trace preserving that. Yeah. And you won't be surprised, I guess, to hear that the answer is yes. So what we want here is not a theorem that tells us that just an exchangeable sequence of outcomes of measurements has this Diffinetti form. I mean, that would basically just be the same as the state version of the theorem. This actually, we want there to be a notion of an unknown measurement, as in an unknown POVM. But you know, it might be, for example, that you don't know whether the measurement is in the 0-1 basis or the plus-minus basis. That's not the same as not knowing whether the first outcome is 0 or plus, and separately not knowing whether the second outcome is minus or 1. So it needs to sort of include all of the outcomes in one go. And that means that the definition of exchangeability comes out like this. And then you get the Diffinetti form again. And again, following the pattern from before, the way to prove this is going to be to piggyback on the things that came before. In particular, you can view a POVM as just a particular type of channel. It's one where the output is always a classical state. So the output is always diagonal in the computational basis. And then you just have to check that an exchangeable POVM corresponds to an exchangeable sequence of POVMs corresponds to an exchangeable sequence of channels. Then you can apply the theorem for channels. Again, the slightly annoying thing is that just tells you it's a mixture of channels, whereas we need this to be a mixture of measurements, which means we need to check that all of the things in that integral are actually channels that give you classical states rather than just arbitrary channels. But actually, we can get that by using some of these other Diffinetti theorems. If you imagine applying, so this is the channel that you get from doing the measurement on n systems all in one go, and that gives you some great big classical probability distribution. But since these measurements are exchangeable, that's going to give you an exchangeable classical probability distribution. And so you can apply the classical Diffinetti theorem to say that it has the Diffinetti form. But even though this is diagonal in the computational basis, it is still a quantum state, which means we can apply the uniqueness part of the quantum Diffinetti theorem for quantum states to say that that representation we got from the classical one, where it was a mixture of classical probability distributions, is exactly the one that we got from the Diffinetti theorem for channels. And that means the one we got out from the channels was actually a mixture of channels that gave classical outputs. Okay?
Is it that you're doing a certain measurement, but you don't know what the measurement is measuring, but you're doing the same one every time?
Yeah. So
if you have a sort of black box that is doing some measurement, then you can characterize it by just feeding in a spanning set of states and working out the probabilities for each one. Okay. But if you don't think that there really is some problem that lives inside that box, then this is just trying to answer what you're actually doing in that case. And the exchangeability criteria are just an expression of your belief that each time you use the box, it's doing the same thing.
Can you show us that exchangeability criteria?
So the idea is that this effect, for example, represents that you've used the box three times. First time you got outcome I, the second time you got outcome J, the third time you got outcome K. And the idea is that you believe that if you'd have put those systems in a different order, you would have just got those outcomes in a different order.
What is it? You're assuming about the system. Are you assuming something about the dimension of the Hilbert space that it
goes
with? Or?
So these all act on, if E1 acts on a D-dimensional Hilbert space, then E2 acts on a D-squared dimensional, and E3 on a D-squared dimensional. So
that's a fixed input, or you're not randomizing over. You're not trying to deduce what's the dimension of the Hilbert space?
No.
Okay.
I'm not sure that's it.
I'm not saying you should, I'm just trying to get
So the idea is you...
But you'll just get some outcomes. The answer can only characterize a state up to some unitary equivalence or something like that.
So the idea is you're feeding in states for which you know what states you're feeding in.
But you know the state you're feeding in.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's just kind of the opposite. In state topography, you know what measurements you're doing and you're trying to characterize the state. Here, you know what states you're putting in and you're trying to characterize the measurement. I mean, that's actually probably the more interesting question, is what should you do if you don't know either? Which is something we've been trying to think about. So this doesn't actually...
Just to be provocative, I mean, you say there are no states. So you can't feed in a known state.
you can feed in a state that you have, that you believe is a particular state. And, yeah. And from that, you're going to start building up beliefs about what the measuring devices do. But yeah, there's nothing objectively correct about those beliefs under this scheme.
I mean, as echoing Lee, you might get into an infinite regress. Why do we believe that state is the same state? Anyway, I don't want
to. I mean, your beliefs about a state don't have to come from state tomography.
No.
They can come from your understanding of the physics of what's going on or whatever.
That's a general question. In the classical case, people don't talk about tomography of stochastic matrices, the classical analog of a channel. And so I presume that's because it's really just tomography of a conditional probability. I think a very stochastic matrix describing a classical probabilistic evolution as just a conditional probability. And my question is there any subtlety in extending the Diffinetti theorem to conditional probabilities?
There is a bit of a subtlety because it might not be that you just don't know what the conditional probability of y given x equals to a, and you don't know the probability distribution for y given x equals to b. But you might actually, for example, you might think either this is the identity channel or this is the bit flip channel. Right? So that's not the same as just independent from trying to work out what happens when you put in 0 and what happens when you put in 1. It's actually you know, if you put in zero and you got out one, you'd immediately conclude it was the bit flip channel without having to do tomography on what happens when you put in one. But there is a version of the difficulty theorem.
So presumably you could have proven, say, the channel version of Diffinetti using the same kinds of tricks that Case, Fuchs, and Schacht used, where now you sort of imagine putting in an informationally complete set of states and doing an informationally complete measurement, and then using the fact that the conditional probabilities satisfy a classical Diffinetti theorem.
Yeah. I suspect that would have been harder than the way they did it.
Thanks.
So I said we wanted to complete the puzzle. There is actually one last little bit, which is you might care about what happens to the system after you put them through this measuring device, in which case what you're interested in is what I'm calling a quantum instrument, by which I just mean a set of completely positive maps that sums to a trace-preserving map. And so actually you might want a Diffinetti theorem for those when you can get them. So that this would be, you know, you feed in, you've got this box that has an input, lights light up on it, and then the system comes out, and you characterize that by putting various known states in and then doing various known measurements on the output and looking at when the lights flash. So this is sort of an instrument tomography. Then that works as well. It's just a little bit tricky.
Wait, so that requires a POVM at the end still?
Yeah, to characterize what comes out of the unknown thing. So that's the conclusion measurement thing. Are there any more questions about Diffinetti theorem?
I'm maybe a bit confused about the symmetricity condition that seems to come up. Suppose I have this box, right, and I put in, say, three copies of the same state. Now, since the E of like some other system that goes through, which I kind of talk about as a state, now, if they're exactly the same, I mean, how is the symmetricity non-trivial in the sense that they're indistinguishable what I feed in? So, say if I put in the first one and the third one, the second one, instead of the other way around, how is there any physical difference from doing it the other way if I know that the systems I put in are indistinguishable?
Yeah, that's exactly the point.
Right.
So the idea is that you believe that there's no difference between them, and therefore, inevitably, your quantum state will be a symmetric.
So the symmetricity is kind of something I say about those systems that I feed in, more so than about the black box that's supposed to be my measurement.
Which theorem are we talking about here, though?
Really, anything, any of them, both the state and the quantum state ones. Probably.
Okay. So this sort of condition.
Right.
So the idea is that, say, for example, you have a box and it just keeps spitting out qubits. You know, you might think it's spitting out those qubits prepared in the binary digits of pi, right?
Mm-hmm.
In which case, this wouldn't represent your beliefs. On the other hand, you might think, no, it's really doing the same sort of thing each time. In which case, your beliefs would be symmetric. You know, you think the... You don't know anything about the third one and the second one that you don't think also applies to the second one.
Maybe I actually meant more in terms of like the measurements, which is really good.
I think maybe the question is, what would it mean to do that sequence of measurements in a different order? Is that the basic of your question?
Essentially, I think so.
So if you had an ensemble of many different systems, you could imagine that you believe to be identical, if that's an allowed statement, then you could imagine doing them in measuring them in different orders. But if it's just repetitions of the same activity on the same system, then it seems that as if it has no meaning to do it in a different order.
You could imagine permuting the things you put into the measurement rather than sort of fiddling around with the measurement itself.
And if you just have something that's generating an input and over it, you just press a button over and over again. So it seems that there are situations in which there's no meaning to doing that sequence of observations in a different order. I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe in some situations there wouldn't be, but the situation we're talking about here is one where you have this sort of unknown measuring device, but you do have control over its input, in which case you could think about feeding the systems in a different order. In order to do tomography to work out what measurement it's doing, you're going to need to have control over its input.
Well, let's go back to the original dependent, one where you said quantum states don't exist, or classical probabilities don't exist. Either one of those. I think the point of the objection is that there exist situations in which we would want to apply probability in the standard way, but we can't make sense of this exchanging of the sequence.
I mean, it doesn't have to be any sort of physical exchange. It's really just you have an indifference about how those systems are labeled, for example, right? You don't care whether you call this use of it use number 2 and this use number 5, or whether you label them the other way around, because you don't think the uses are any different.
So then the symmetricity...
It doesn't have to be a sort of active, you know, fiddling around.
So is there any more condition on, like, the mathematical way you express your degrees of belief more so than any physical difference? It was a labeling. I mean, labeling, it's nothing physical. It just shows up in how you arrange the matrices or something.
But I mean, there could be cases where the labeling does, right? If it was doing different things on different runs of the experiment, then it would matter how you labeled the runs of the experiment.
Right, but then the condition is essentially kind of constrained and how you can express it mathematically. I mean, I'm trying to get like a meaning of the significance of the symmetricity. I'm not sure if I am. That's something I'm not quite understanding.
So the idea is it's a property of your beliefs, but since your beliefs are expressed in this mathematical form, it takes a mathematical form.
But you have to be the belief has to be about something.
It's about these future classical. In the classical case, it's just about these future random variables.
Yeah, so I think the point is there might be situations where you can't really distinguish one random variable from the other, except by the time at which that experiment was performed. And then you're not free to exchange the order.
Yeah, but...
So in those situations, the question is, does this theorem really give us anything?
Even if you don't have control about what time the experiment happens, you might still nevertheless think that the time at which the experiment happens isn't relevant.
If the temperature was increasing throughout the course of the day, you might think the time was important. If the temperature wasn't increasing throughout the course of the day, no other variables were making you think the heat repetition was any different, then you'd be indifferent to what label you use for heat repetition.
Yeah, but the label is not the act. If you say, I believe I get the same result no matter how I label the outcomes, that's a different from belief than saying that I would get the same result. I mean, that's mathematical triviality, to say I'd get the same result no matter how I labeled the outcomes.
Well,
it's not a triviality to say.
So if
I had 5 different systems and I measured them in some different order, I would get the same probability distribution. Even if the temperature was increasing, you'd still say, as long as you kept the right temperature with the label, you'd still say the answer wouldn't depend on the label.
You could imagine it in the following operational way. I tell you, I've taken these 17 measurements. Now I'm going to permute them at random and ask you to predict what outcome I got for each one in my random permutation. Uh-huh. And so you have to ask yourself, does it matter? Like, is your prediction about what the relative probability sequence outcomes is going to be, does it depend on the fact that I've done a random permutation or not? If not, then you have exchangeable beliefs. If it does, then you don't.
Mm-hmm. I had another question about this. Could you imagine proving similar theorems, but in the context of sort of general probabilistic theories, but where you have local tomography? I think I remember from Chris Lutz's paper that local tomography was an important property in proving their quantum definitive thing. Is there anything like you're proving these in the case of quantum theory, but could you imagine proving it just for general probabilistic theory, including quantum theory and classical quantum theory special cases?
Matt Leifer, amongst others, I can't remember who, have got a paper where they prove a definity theorem for the states in generalized probabilistic theories. That includes the theorem for quantum states and the theorem for classical probability distributions in special cases. And in fact, the one for conditional probability distributions is also.
But only under the condition of local tomography.
Yeah, if you don't have local tomography, it's not even clear how you'd state the requirement of exchangeability.
Matt, you've got 10 minutes if you want to do the other bit.
I might have to give up on that.
As you know,
it's given up. So does one undertake this kind of a theorem as actually in the hopes that one could actually falsify the belief that one can maintain the quantum states are subjective, like that it might not work out and therefore one would have to abandon the view of the quantum state? Or is it really just kind of, this is more of like a personal taste, like do you do this because you, just for completeness, or because you, it's like a realistic, it's a realistic approach to try and see if the assumption that quantum states are subjective is tenable by this consistency condition?
I certainly was, pretty sure that there would be this result for measurement, since there was already one for states and for channels. But the one for states doesn't hold in real quantum mechanics, basically because of the failure of local tomography. So I don't think it's a totally trivial thing that these things exist. And I do think that if they didn't exist, then the people with these sorts of beliefs about quantum states probably would have to try and tell another story of what's going on when you do state tomography. Because, on the face of it, it is something that jars quite heavily with having a completely subjective interpretation.
What's the failure you're talking about?
If you just do normal quantum mechanics but only using real numbers,
oh, real, I see.
Then there are
that's what you meant. I see.
Exchangeable sequences of quantum states that don't have this representation.
Because local tomography fails when you have only real numbers.
So I mentioned to you that Judea Pearl had a comment in some paper about understanding the assumption of exchangeability as a commitment to a particular kind of causal structure. And so I'm thinking that it might correspond to assuming that there's, say, some variable which is a common cause of the of all the systems you're considering, and also that the sort of conditional probability for system one given this variable and system two given this variable are all the same. Does that sound right to you?
But then, so that, if you had a situation like that, you would just immediately write down the sort of Definetti type form. My question would be, what do you think that variable underneath is? That one that's causing all of the
So for example, if I believe that, you know, there's a game show host who gets to decide which of 17 preparation procedures going to be done on all the systems, then there's this 17 outcome variable. I have a prior over, you know, what the game show host is going to pick, and that's what fixes it. So that's a causal justification of the exchangeability assumption.
Sorry, what was the variable that caused all of the 17 things?
It is just a 17 outcome classical variable describing, you know, the possibilities for the game show host. And so let me ask my question a different way. So what I was thinking is if I take another kind of causal structure that is kind of simple in a way. So suppose I imagine that pairs of systems are allowed to have, like, instead of having sort of one common cause for all systems, I could have clusters of systems all having a common cause, and maybe pairs of systems can have different common causes, or, you know, M element subsets. So I guess I haven't got a clear proposal for how you might generalize the Diffinity theorem, but I'm imagining that you might be able to consider sort of new causal structures that also lead to certain kinds of exchangeability properties for your state assignment, and therefore a more general decomposition would be possible. So like in a quantum case, your decomposition was separable among all the systems, but maybe I could have a convex combination of states which allow bipartite entanglement in all possible ways, and a certain assumption about the causal structure would lead me to assign those kinds of quantum states. Anyhow, I guess I haven't thought clearly enough about this, but do you see anything wrong with this, the idea that, you know, in the straight up exchangeability assumption, I can justify that by saying there's a single common cause for all the systems?
It's not clear to me whether or not that would just be a sort of device for bringing in some objective probability. Like, if the objective probability is just the value of that variable that's causing all of the other things, then it's kind of like you are taking the objective point of view, you've just drawn a nice picture for it.
I don't think it forces you to that, because I could always imagine that, you know, the reason I don't know the value of this variable given my common cause is because the value of this variable doesn't depend only on the value of the common cause, but on some environmental variable as well, which I don't have access to. But I could say, well, the way it depends on that is the same for every system. So I have ignorance by virtue of not knowing the environment, but all the dynamics is deterministic, and this ignorance is just subjective.
So are you ignoring certain causes that you know are there, but you just treat as negligible? Because like in this case where you repeat the same measurement over, see, in principle, the result of one can influence the next one. But you're sort of making an abstract causal structure, a sort of reduced causal structure that leaves out the causes that you regard as not being physically relevant.
It's not that they're not physically relevant, it's that you're not conditioning on their values. So I have to say what the value of the first coin is, you know, given this value, some parameter that kind of, you know, there's a parameter that figures out which of a set of coins gets picked out of some bucket, you know, or there's different buckets with different weightings. So I might know the value of that parameter, but the value of, you know, the positions of the molecules in the room that determine whether it comes up heads or tails, that I don't know. And therefore I have ignorance about whether it was heads or tails.
Right, but I'm thinking of a sequence of these coin flips or whatever they're picking out of the bucket. So in principle, the one that happens later could be influenced by the outcome of the one that happens earlier. So there wouldn't be a common cause. The causal structure wouldn't be just like a comb or whatever you want. It wouldn't be just like a little bush. It would actually be a linear chain. In reality, that's true somehow.
That helps me formalize my question, which is, it's possible that
it's an if and only if, that you could say, if the causal structure is not of the form I described, where there's one variable that's the common cause of everything, if there's, say, an arrow from event one to event two and event two to event three, like that would be your sort of causal chain, then it's not of Diffinity form in general. So then it would say sort of this is the only causal structure that has Diffinity form and all the others don't.
Right.
That would be a strong result.
But sometimes in the real world we idealize things that really don't have the Diffinity form as if they did have the Diffinity.
Do we actually have a finite version, or is it just the infinite version?
No, I don't have it. Okay. I would be very surprised if it wasn't. And it, I think the finite ones actually generally are the more useful ones, like seeing them used in proofs for quantum cryptography.
There's a more general object around this sort of quantum instruments that you talk about, and this would be something like what the Pavia group calls quantum cones, or what they call fragments, which is where you have some object that can have sort of, that's maybe extended in time, so it can have outputs that can go back into inputs on the same object. So. So, for example, one way of achieving that would be to wire together some quantum operations. So, if I have three quantum operations, this one, and another one, maybe outputs from the bottom one can go into the top one. So, this thing has sort of legs that go into the bottom, legs in the middle, legs at the top. So, that's sort of the most general object in some sense that you can consider in quantum theory. It's more general than states or instruments or PWMs. So one could ask whether you could prove a quantum Diffinity theorem in the context of that.
Can you do tomography on this?
Yeah, so again, tomography, just by having sort of you can do process tomography, or the thing which is analogous to process tomography on this object, just by having preparations and measurements on each of the inputs and outputs wherever they are. So probably, yeah, you would have that point. It's one further step of generality. So presumably you haven't thought about that.
No. You just reminded me of something which I intended to point out, which was that the instrument one includes the state one and the channel one,
right, yeah.
Special cases.
Yeah. So I'm just saying there's a more general object which includes instruments known as special cases. And there's nothing more general than that.
So the claim that there's nothing more general than that would have to rely on the notion that the maps, so Pavia, people call these super maps. They take in channels and they output channels. Mm-hmm. Then there's super duper maps, which take in super maps.
Aren't
the super maps.
Aren't there just cones with more legs?
Well, so I remember this at one of our conferences, there was sort of a bone of contention between the Pavia group's claim that there isn't anything more general than a super map and Peter Selinger's work. Okay. So Peter Selinger was giving a talk and he said that that wasn't right.
Okay.
So I don't know the details, but I think there's a non-trivial issue.
Maybe even more theorems.
An exchangeable sequence.
So I left this question to last. If anyone else has a question, they should ask it.
It's just going to blow.
It's me, right? Yeah. It might be like bringing up many worlds or something. You never get to talk about anything else after. So you say states, quantum states don't exist, maybe measurements don't exist. So what does exist?
I don't know. I suppose one thing that this sort of picture makes it look like it does exist is the dimension of the quantum system. Right, that was always fixed. So I don't know whether you can make sense of the notion of a quantum system of unknown dimension or not.
Couldn't you do it just as you did?
I don't even know
what
the mathematical structure would be in that case.
Well, while we're at it. So this coin thing, I mean, if I have a biased coin, then what I'm referring to specifically by calling it a biased coin is that, you know, there's some physical bias to the coin, which makes it give heads 60% of the time. So somehow the coin exists, and that's a property of the coin, and it's somehow in one-to-one correspondence with the probabilities I'm going to get. But where is my error in that line of, I mean, you know, I know that I'm always wrong when I talk to Bayesians about probability. I always need them to point out my assumption.
Yeah, in some ways the coin is sort of a bad example, I suppose, because you can imagine that one side of the coin is objectively heavier than the other, for example. But then I suppose the Bayesian response would be, well, actually, you can't just go straight from even a complete physical description of a coin to probabilities for outcomes of a coin toss, because, you know, if you just pick up the coin and put it on the table with heads facing up, you could call that a coin tossing procedure, and that would have a very different probability distribution to one where you throw it 1,000 miles into the air, spinning rapidly. So, you know, no matter how much you know about the coin, you're still feeding in beliefs about other things in order to actually finally end up with a probability. And so a sort of subjectiveness is saved in that way. But yeah, the coin is maybe a bad example. You can maybe think of biased coin tossing procedures. Like, you know, you're asking two different people to toss a coin and you suspect that one of them might be doing it in a way that results in heads more often.
But I think it is the same. The question is, what are you believe? You have these beliefs. Beliefs about what? So
beliefs about
you
what's
take
going
away.
To happen. No, just
so
beliefs about the future.
So doesn't that work? I thought Bayesian, or some of them, I thought, well, Chris certainly would. I think in the end, he's not an operationalist, although he might appear to be one. It sounds like you're just adopting. I couldn't even call it instrumentalism because you don't think the instrument either. So I don't know what I can call it. But something exists. Outcomes exist. Are you limiting yourself really to that? Just those things as the only real things?
I mean, first of all, I'm not like a diehard advocate of this view. And certainly if you're sort of proving these sorts of results, yeah, all you need to assume is that there are these outcomes that you should have beliefs about. That's pretty much it.
Are there biased coins? Do they exist? Can you buy one on the internet?
Sometimes you have two.
I bet you can.
Even the full bias.
I think Bayesian would actually say, even in the case of just like a biased coin, they would say, you know, there might be some properties of the coin that are relevant for my beliefs, but the probability of heads I write down is not a property of the coin because, for instance, if I could show that, you know, knowing enough about the flipping mechanism would allow me to predict the outcome, you know, better than merely knowing the mass distribution of the coin, well, then I assign a different probability, even though, you know, so different people who have different knowledge of the flipping mechanism would assign different probabilities, even though the properties of the coins are all the same. I think that's the kind of story they would give as to why it's inappropriate to just think of that probability as an objective property of the coin.
But it's definitely interesting if you consider just contrasting two coins to keep everything else fixed, flipping mechanism and so on.
I mean, things are allowed to have objective properties, and you're allowed to take those objective properties into account when you decide on probability. The only claim is that the objective facts don't uniquely determine a single probability distribution. I mean, they might, you know, in some cases they'll determine a probability distribution for all practical purposes that anyone sane would would use. You know, if there's absolutely nothing to distinguish the two sides of the coin, why on earth would you assign anything other than a uniform distribution? But still, they would claim that that's not actually a property.
So I'd like to criticize your slogan, measurements do not exist. I'm not sure if you meant that as a joke or not, but so you know the slogan probabilities do not exist, I think could be cashed out as what probabilities represent are not objective properties of systems, but rather quantifications of agents subjective to reason belief. And then the slogan quantum states are do not exist is cashed out as what, you know, unit trace positive operators represent is not objective properties of systems, but rather the degrees of belief of some agent. And then so I would cash out, kind of, I wouldn't use measurements there, I'd use POVMs do not exist, is to be understood as those mathematical objects we call POVMs do not represent, you know, maybe physical properties of measurement procedures or the systems upon which you're doing measurement procedures, but rather our degrees of belief about the outcome of those procedures given the input or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
So these comments about how you don't think measurements exist and only outcomes exist, I mean, your answer is no, I think measurement devices exist. It's just POVMs don't describe objective properties of those measurement devices, but rather some agents' subjective degrees of belief about those properties. Correct?
Yeah.
Which is worse?
It's interesting that there's a sort of problem in our language that we talk about states and effects, which are elements of POVMs, in the same way. Then we talk about preparations, and there's no word that's analogous to an effect.
Like
you say, preparation for measurement, but like it's measurement. A measurement is the whole thing. Whereas measurement with the outcome is sort of not. There isn't really a word in our vocabulary. So preparations are to what as states are to effects.
Or maybe observation.
Yeah, I mean, I started using the word results, but there isn't an accepted word.
So they give me like a measurement outcome pair.
Yeah.
One event, maybe.
But event could be as a much more general notion.
In the quantum logic literature, they sometimes use the word test for that.
For the pair.
But I'm sorry.
Like measurement and outcome pair.
Yeah. Oh, is it?
Test.
I always thought test.
Yeah, you're right. In some quantum logic, a test is a set of outcomes, and then it's a measurement. But in other bits, a test is just basically two outcome measurements. You can think of every one of your outcomes as sort of coarse graining all the outcomes into it and the rest. And strictly speaking, that's what they call the test. Maybe that's not what you're looking for. So that's a different theoretical entity, the two outcome measurement,
yeah,
as opposed to just the measurement and its outcome.
That's right, test is two outcome measurement. Yeah, no, I just want the measurement outcome pair.
Right.
Yeah.
Including the input? Measurement outcome.
So if I have a measurement apparatus, and then I further specify a particular outcome.
But not an you don't specify an input to it.
Which input? You mean the knob setting? Or?
Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah,
you fed in a system or something?
No, because that's the sort of thing that's waiting, just like a preparation. If you say I have a preparation, you don't then specify the measurement on the preparation. Anyway, it's just the...
I see.
Observation about the linguistic difficulty of calling when you have measurements versus your view.
Okay.
Any other questions? No, I'll just think that again.